This is episode number 409 with Tony Coe of the Founder Podcast.
What you need is thirst. You need to be a thirsty human
who is intent on learning.
It's a really fascinating exploration of human potential.
Now. The Founder Podcast. Even the greatest entrepreneurs had help. If you want to learn from the most successful founders on the planet, you are in the right place. Branson, Mark Cuban, Tony Robbins, Tim Ferriss, Arianna Huffington, Seth Godin, Steve Case, Gary Vee, Sophia Amoroso, Barbara Corcoran, Damon John. Learn from the greatest minds in business today with interviews hosted by Nathan Chan. This is not your average entrepreneur podcast. The Founder Podcast.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in. Before we start today's episode, I just want to let you know that our goal at Founder is to help entrepreneurs succeed however we can by giving away high quality content in the form of interviews, blog posts, podcasts, YouTube videos, you name it. We put out so much content to help you. And another interesting project that we're working on right now is partnering with world-class founders like Damon John, Alexa Von Tobel, Greta Van Riel, and so many more to teach crucial skills like negotiation, finance, e-commerce, and so much more. So if you'd like to get access to these free trainings with founders like this, which is 100% free, just go to founder.com/free. Okay, so now let's talk about today's episode. Hey, Founder fam, welcome back to another episode. Hope you're doing well wherever you are around the world. Today's guest, Tony, is a first-generation immigrant who came here from Korea at the age of 13, not speaking a word of English. She built the global brand NYX Cosmetics from the ground up when she was only 25 and generated $4 million in retail sales in her first year. She then went on to sell NYX to L'Oreal in 2014 for a reported $500 million, which at the time was one of the biggest beauty acquisitions in history. Today, she's here to talk to us about how to build incredible products, what it's like to sell your company, and the journey in between and after. Please welcome to the podcast, Tony Coe. The first question that we ask everyone that comes on is, how did you get your job, aka how did you find yourself doing the work you're doing today?
So when I first started my company, I was 25 going on 26. It was long, long time ago, age of the dinosaurs. But it was 1998 going on 1999. And I was working in the family business for a very long time. And I decided to leave the family business and start something on my own. And actually, in between that, I was actually going to get a job. And then I realized that I'm very stubborn and I don't like to take orders and I don't like the boxed 9-to-5 style. And I would probably make a horrible employee and probably get fired in 3 days. So I had to become an entrepreneur. I had no other option but to become an entrepreneur.
Okay. And what did those early stages look like bringing the company to life? Did you have a background in cosmetics or?
Well, I have my background as being the consumer, the ultimate consumer, probably. But I worked in the family business, like I said earlier, and our family business was in beauty supply, perfumes and cosmetics. So we started as a retailer and then we moved on to become a distributor wholesaler. So I had that experience, but you know, I'm not your HBS, like formally trained business person, but I could say that I'm a third generation entrepreneur in my family. So my grandfather was an entrepreneur. He was in textile business. My father was an entrepreneur. My mom's an entrepreneur. So I just grew up in a very entrepreneurial family. And I spent a lot of time growing up with my, with my grandfather, who was an amazing business person, actually. And I think it just like this entrepreneurial spirit rubbed off on me. And I learned so much from being around my grandfather and my dad and my mom. My mom's an amazing businesswoman. I learned so much from her. So that's how I got my first start at 23 years ago. And back in 1999, a young female just did not start a business. These days, it's very common to see a lot of young entrepreneurs or female entrepreneurs or young female entrepreneurs, but this was very rare in 1999. But just like you don't know what you don't know, I've always seen my mother as an entrepreneur. She always worked, and it was just very natural to me.
Yeah, I see. So can you take us back as well? So when you immigrated to America, you were 13. What was on your vision board at that time? Like, what did the future look like for younger Tony?
Oh, like at 13. Oh my goodness, at 13, so innocent. So I was born and raised in Korea until I was 13 years old. And this is 1986. I'm talking about a long time ago. And back then in South Korea, there was no such a thing as a sex ed or like anything like that. So I was 13. I was so innocent. Like now I look back when I was 13 and like looking at the kids who are 13 these days, and I can't believe what they know now. And I can't believe what I didn't know back then. Vision board, wow. At 13, all I wanted to do was go to Disneyland. That was my vision board.
So do you think that you had, because of your family and the generational experiences as entrepreneurs, do you think that you were born to be an entrepreneur? And I'd love to hear. Do you think people are born to be entrepreneurs?
Yeah, you know, of course there's the entrepreneurs by training later on in the year. But I think like being an entrepreneur is kind of a talent, like hidden born talent as well. Because at first of all, you know, you have to have a personality that is okay taking a lot of risk and without any reward for a very long time. Because just because you start a business doesn't mean that you're going to turn profit immediately. So you get yourself into this situation where you're working 80, 90, 100, 120 hours, like you hear about these stories, right? And you put your capital in while you're not producing any income. It may be all investment in the beginning, and you have to wake up every day and be okay with it. So there's that personality. I think there's that inherent personality quality to be an entrepreneur. And I happen to be an eternal optimist. And I come up with business ideas all the time. Like I walk around on the street and I start like just pulling ideas out of my head. It's like, oh my God, like this would do great. Like just in a conversation or like, I don't know, just like random everyday, everything. I am a very solution driven person. So if I'm eating something and I don't like how a salt shaker shakes or like just I try to fix every little thing. And then like everything is like, oh, my God, it's like I just go into like this mode of, oh, my God, like if somebody launched this, it's going to be amazing. Like I'm just born an optimist. It's very hard for me to look for reasons not to or look for reasons why it cannot work. Maybe it's a quality that I lack that benefited me, but everything I look at, I tend to just jump immediately into why it's going to work instead of why it's not going to work.
I love it. So when you first started Nix, you guys made $4 million in your first year, which is pretty impressive. Like, what was the initial offering and how did you kind of get that kind of traction so quickly?
Yeah, that was $4 million in retail value. So that was net of wholesale revenue of $2 million. 1999, I was 26 years old and I was the first year I started the business, I made myself a self-made millionaire.
That's crazy.
But I was a one-woman company. It was me, myself, and I. I say I had three employees, me, myself, and I. Three of us did everything. And I had a small showroom in downtown Los Angeles. It was 600 square feet. I think my rent was $1,200 or something. It was inside California Mart. And then I was renting without paying rent, a little bit of a warehouse space at my mom's business that was on the second floor, walk up, no elevator. And these boxes were 38 pounds each. I would never forget. And I was in my mid 20s and I love makeup. I love fashion. I love beauty. So I used to wear high heels almost every day. I still do almost every day. And I used to carry these 38 pound boxes up and down and up and down, and up and down the stair all day long. I was the receptionist, the secretary, the president, the designer, accounting person, customer service. I did everything myself. And now I look back, actually, it was like one of the best years of my life. I had so much fun.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. I hear that kind of common thread. People love the early days looking back where you don't have a care in the world. You don't have your team members to worry about, less responsibility. It's scary at the time, but you're just kind of having fun and being free.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, another thing is, it's like you have nothing to lose. And that just frees you from so much pressure and the responsibility that you have to have, right? Because so I've exited out of NYX Cosmetic. That was my first company in 2014. So ran the company for 15 years. And during the 15 years, it came from like three employees, me, myself, and I, to being 250 employees at the end. And the thing is, like, when it was just myself, every decision that I made only affected me. Like, it's not going to hurt anybody if anything goes wrong. So, you know, there's that like, I did not have that pressure. But when you have 200, like 200, 300, 400 employees, sometimes like you're supporting not the 200, 300, 400 employees, but their extended family members. You know, the salary that they take may pay for their children's college tuition, put food on the table. So when you have all these variables that goes into your decision making, the pressure, this is why, like, the pressure cooker, all entrepreneurs are under constant pressure cooker. That's guaranteed.
Yeah. So let's go back. I'd love to kind of still explore those early days. So what products did you launch with to make, $2 million in sales in 1 year?
Very simple. Cosmetic pencils, lip liners, and eyeliners. That's all I had. In the liner, I had 12 colors. In the eyeliner, I had 6 colors. So combined, it was 18 SKUs of product, but basically one item because they're cosmetic pencils. And I was wholesaling that at 55 cents a piece. So when you do the number, I sold close to 2 million pieces of these cosmetic pencil the first year I had launched. And the reason, and people go like, but how, it doesn't make sense. But because it was revolutionary at the time, the product that I was offering, not revolutionary in a way where the formula was like nothing like it was out in the market. That's not true. There have been other formulas, like great formula, like the one that I had. And there have been lip liner, eyeliner categories that are in the price point that I was in. It's just that until I had started NYX Cosmetics, no one had married or merged the affordable pricing with the stylish packaging of a department store product. It was as simple as that. So when you went to, like, think about Chanel. Simplest packaging ever. It's black and it's got a white logo. That's it. Right? And that's how it was in the department store. And then when you went to the lower tier budget line cosmetics, it was really gaudy. Like, you know, it was really gaudy. Hot pink, green, gold foil, like silver foil, and like logos that are like out of proportion size logos. And I wanted my product to look like department store products, simple, chic, and elegant, but sell it at a price that was at the mass market price point. And once I did that, these products like literally flew off the shelf. I have stories from like a retail, like one store customer who are selling 60 pieces of these pencils each day. Yeah, it was revolutionary. So one thing that it had done, because the products were selling by itself, because it looked expensive, the quality was really good, and then price was really cheap. That's the best combination for any business, right? Value. When you sell a great product at a great price, like, you're golden, right? And that was what's going on. And so these products were selling so fast and so well. One thing I had never had to do was I didn't really have to sell. Like, I went to trade shows and I did a lot of booth exhibitions, but it was more so the customers were coming, like, looking for me and coming to me instead of me going to have to go to a store and open an account or something like that. And I'm so glad, because I am good at a lot of things, but one thing I'm really not good at is sales. Yeah, I'm not a sales-driven business owner or founder or CEO or like whatever you may call it.
Yeah, I see. So what were some of the early challenges or biggest early challenges? Like, was it just all flying?
You know, like, as ridiculous as it sounds, I really did not have a lot of challenges because the products were selling so well. I mean, I did have a little bit of a capital strain in the beginning because I had to pay my suppliers upfront cash, but I was giving credit to my customers. So between paying my suppliers upfront and then issuing credits to my customer and collecting, so there was that little bit of a cash strain. But besides that, I had to move very frequently. That was really stressful because we were, but on a good stressful, because we're growing so fast, we had to move like every 18 to 2 years for the first four moves, I think. And then ultimately I said, like, I don't want to do it anymore. Like, I can't move around anymore. So I ended up buying a warehouse, a really large warehouse. I actually stayed at that location until the exit of my company. But besides that, I mean, hard work, but I mean, that's a package deal. If you are an entrepreneur, if you are a business owner, like, that is given. So I wouldn't even put that under stress.
Yeah. So I'd love to explore something that you said before, which is very interesting to me. I've never heard this before. You said you're not a sales person. You're not very good at sales. You're not a sales driven entrepreneur. Can we go a bit deeper there? Because really, like, sales cures all, right? Like, and so, yeah, let's talk about that a bit more.
Yeah. So when you look at a lot of entrepreneurs, you will see that a lot of the entrepreneurs are actually very sales-driven business owners or entrepreneurs. I'm a creative person. So my specialty is in product design, product packaging, formulation, marketing. That's my specialty. And I cannot for the life of me go to somebody and say, will you buy this? I don't know. I just can't. But I think what it is that for a person to become successful and run a successful company, number one important thing is to figure out what you are good at and what you're not good at. And a lot of the times, a lot of the founding entrepreneurs want to do everything And of course, in the beginning, you do have to do everything. But, you know, as the company grows, the most important is to like really figure out, okay, like my talent, this is what I'm really good at. This is not what I'm not good at. And hire the right people to take over the job that you're not really good at. And it's an admission, like it's an acceptance that you have to give yourself. Like some people don't like the acceptance that they're not good at a certain job categories, but you have to accept it and say, and you have to be able to accept it and you have to be able to let it go. So you can find the right people to fill those positions for you.
So it sounds like very quickly, or even when you first started, you had that self-awareness. You knew, like even starting, that you weren't going to, yet, like you were just going to focus on product and marketing and packaging. And
I did sales as well in the beginning, of course, because it was just one, like myself. And I think this is where the luck factor comes in. Like, so I do think sometimes, like, what if I had started a company and the products were not flying off the shelf immediately and I had to go and sell these products? Me being not an amazing salesperson, maybe it would have taken longer for the brand to establish, or maybe the brand may not have taken off the way it did. But these are the luck factors, right? So luckily, the products that I was selling were good enough for the products to fly off the shelf. Thus, I did not have to do a job that I was not good at.
I really appreciate your openness and honesty. So the products were flying off the shelf. Like, how did you know when to expand the range, and what did that scaling piece look like?
I think the first 2 years, we kept it very simple. I launched a second product category probably about 2 years later, and then a third category about 3 years into the business. And from that point on, we're just like constant roll of launching new products. And then, of course, the company was growing so fast. We're growing double digits every year, and like my team was growing, and everything after that was like the first 3 years. I call first 3 years the infant mortality years in like the investment world, I guess. So it's the first 3 years, whether you make it or you don't make it. A lot of companies that go under within 3 years. A lot of the majority of the companies that make it past 3 years end up being a stable company brand. And then they really start expanding and growing. There's like a growth spur, like at a 3 year mark. So after 3 years, like we started growing like really fast. And I really saw the growth spur in 3 year mark. Another one came at like a 5 year mark. Another one came at like a 7 year mark. Like they're there's every couple of years, I would see a huge, huge skyrocketing of revenue growth. And it was pretty steady. It was like every couple of years.
Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying this episode and learning a ton. As you know, in this series, we interview some of the greatest founders of our generation to find out how they did it. However, if you're thinking of starting your own business and you want to hear from some incredible stories from everyday people like you or I who are actually in the trenches, only been building their business for maybe 1 year or 2 years, like that are building right now and they're really in the early stages, but they're getting success, you should come and check out our new podcast, From Zero to Founder, hosted by our community manager, Molly Flynn. These are in the trenches stories from our very own successful students that have gone through some of our programs. People just like you who are deep within the process of building their very own successful business. These are the founders of tomorrow. You can find the From Zero to Founder podcast on all platforms. And remember, it's founder without the E. All right, now let's jump in the show.
If you fast forward to now, 2022, you know, there's a lot of brands out there, so many products. What are the biggest mistakes that you see new brands making from all your experience?
My God, it is, especially in my industry, we are very highly oversaturated. But even with the saturations, the brands that do really well do really well. Brands that don't do well don't do well. But some of the mistakes I see is too much expense. And this is because I'm a classical entrepreneur, so to speak. I'm more about live within your means kind of an entrepreneur. So I see other brands growing at such a rapid pace while sacrificing the profitability of the company. And the thing is, sometimes it works. And then a lot of the unicorn companies that we see have become unicorns with that method. But to every one unicorn we see, there are 10 failures that we never hear about. So I think it's a very risky move.
Mm. So talk to us about the exit to L'Oreal and the sale. That was 2014. What was that process like? How did you know it was the right fit? You know, you gave up your baby. Talk to us about that.
Well, I was ready. It was my, it was 2014. Oh my gosh. I can't believe it's been 8 years already. Oh my gosh. Yeah, it was 2014. So in 2009, I had brought on a minority investors. And I raised capital for a growth capital. You know, my company was doing really well, and we're financially completely stable because of my method of living within the means and not overspending. I took the slower growth path. So we were financially okay, but the reason I brought in an investor is because I needed the smart money. I wanted to get into like these large national retail accounts, and I was kind of like hitting a roadblock. I just didn't know how to get in front of the buyers and really expand distribution nationwide. And so I wanted to partner with an investor who had that experience. And so I found an investor who had just gotten out of a hair care industry in the same retail account that I wanted to get into. So I sold 20% of my company to these investors. And when the investors come in to your company, they all have a timeline. And at short end, really short is 3 years, to really long is 10 years, but then the average is 5 to 7 years exit for them, right? So in 2009, when I brought on an investor, it was at that moment, the fate had been decided almost that there was going to be an exit of this company in the next 5 to 7 years. And 2014, it was the winter of 2013, we started talking about the idea of possibly exiting the company, and we started to interview investment bankers to represent our company. And I think the whole process took about 8 to 9 months from the beginning to the final completion. And it was really difficult. Oh my gosh. But that 8-9 months that we spent, oh my God, it's that exhilaration that you get. I mean, the highs and the lows, and it is such an adrenaline driven. I mean, I had the best time, and it was such an amazing experience and educational period for me too. I learned so much during that time, and we finally consummated the deal in July 30 of 2014. And what happened was, like, I got paid on July 30 of 2014. And, you know, like most people think that like we would go out and like pop champagne and party all night, but it was nothing like that. I opened my computer that morning. I went in, so I was still going into office every day. That morning I went into my office, opened my computer, and then got a call from my attorney to check my bank accounts. I go log on and I counted all the zeros and I'm like, okay, it's done. Like, okay. Like it's really sold. It's not mine anymore. And before you sell the company, about 30 days before, they asked me to make a list of all the items that I wanted to keep personally. Like my desk. So this desk right here, it's been refurbished several times along the way, but this desk is from 1999, actually. This desk is a 23-year-old desk that I have moved around with me. Probably like it's been into like 10, 12 different offices with me. I will never get rid of this desk. I will retire with this desk. And so it was my desk, my chair. Like, you know, you make a list. And of course, like I can't take the desk with me. I had to hire a mover to come and take the desk. But I literally walked out with, you know, those mailer box, like those, like UPS mailer box. I walked out of my office with like that one mailer box and I just said bye to my team and I walked out the door, got in my car, came home, and it was really surreal because I'm just like, there, like, this is it? 15 years of my life and some zeros in my bank account and a box of files. That's all I had. And I actually crashed. And I went to sleep because you're coming off of such a high. I passed out and I think I slept for like 12, 13, 14 hours nonstop. I just slept the whole time. And the next morning I got up and I actually jumped in shower and started shampooing my hair. Got, oh my God, I'm late. Da, da, da. And like in the middle of shampooing my hair, I just went, holy smokes. Like, I don't have a work to go to.
Wow. So was it a time of like kind of, did you feel lost after that or?
Very, very, very. I got so depressed. Oh my gosh. It's something that it's, you know, it is a subject that not a lot of entrepreneurs or business world did not talk about. But this is actually very common, especially amongst founding partners, that a lot of people like me, after an exit, actually go through an existential crisis because we've buried like our identity, like our everything, life's purpose, mission, your identity, like your hours, like you baked yourself into the companies that you build. And once that gets removed and you like, and then you go, wait a minute, who am I? Like, that's the first question, right? It starts with who am I? And then why am I here? What's my next purpose? And suddenly you have all these hours because you're so used to working all the time. And you have like all these like leisurely hours and you don't know what to do with the time. Like, I literally did not know what to do with my time. And I actually fell into a deep, deep, deep depression. And it was to a point where I was clinically depressed, and I was going to see a therapist, nothing worked. And so to save myself, I started another company.
Wow. And that really, that's what worked, just starting something else.
I wouldn't say it really worked. It's that there's no magic wand that you could just wave around and, you know, have all your crisis go away. It doesn't work that way. But, you know, it takes your focus off one thing and then you could put your focus in something else. And I think I'm a very different case too, because majority of people, they would have families, right? So, and the majority of people have families and children. So a lot of people's focus can be reshifted to family life, the, you know, spending more time with their children. But I did not have that luxury. So I felt very lonely as well. That was huge, like feeling lonely.
Yeah, I see. Well, look, thank you for sharing and being so vulnerable. So was your next business that you started Bespoke Beauty Brands? And
No. This is my third company. So I had a sunglass company in between that I had for about three and a half years.
Oh, and what happened there?
Complete failure. Complete and utter failure. I had never experienced anything like that in my life. Lost a lot of money, but it was probably the best thing that had happened to me, because it was truly experiencing my ego death. And I'm very grateful. Like, I would pay, like, if I had to do it again, I would actually do it again. So I could learn from that mistake, because what I learned from the mistake has taught me so much. So I am able to start my third business, apply the learnings that I had, and make this company a success.
I see. So can you tell us, how did you start Bespoke Beauty Brands?
Bespoke Beauty Brands, this one is started this. So after I've exited to L'Oreal, I had a 5 years non-compete. And within those 5 years, it was really, really a strict non-compete. So I wasn't able to invest, advise, sit on board, or anything in the beauty space, which included color cosmetics, skincare, and nail care. So I wasn't able to, like, I was completely locked out of the beauty business. Time passes. Time solves everything. So 5 years had passed. July 30, 2019, my non-compete expired. So I started a new company on August 1, 2019. I gave it a 24-hour window. But I launched this company in August of 2019 and launched the first brand on October 18th of 2019. Little did I know that we were going to go into a COVID lockdown. Life, you never know what she's going to throw at you.
And what was the idea behind the brand? Can you go? I'd love to know a little more.
Yeah. So over the 5 years, I've seen the market shift. I've seen the consumer's consciousness shift, consumer behavior. This new generation of consumers, they're so brilliant and they're so smart. And they're very unique, and they like things that are very unique to themselves as well. So for instance, like my last company, like our thing was, we have something for everybody. We have 1,800 SKU, and it was, hey, are you a punk rock star? Here's a product for you. Are you a 65-year-old? Here's a product for you. Are you a 18-year-old college kid? Here's a product for you. Like, we had something for everybody. Like, that was our thing. But what I started to see was a concept like that wasn't as popular as it used to be. Like, people wanted something that is very, that spoke directly to them, brand narrative, like that authentic brand narrative was so important. So what I decided to do was I wanted to partner with different celebrities, influencers, and launch a beauty products for the influencers and the celebrities, and in a very specifically targeted demographic, consumer base, and just focus on that only. So the first brand that we launched is called Kimchi Chic Beauty. So she is a Korean American drag queen, RuPaul's Drag Race season 8, has 2 million followers on Instagram, hugely popular, like very adorable, loved by everybody, no controversy, nothing. Everybody loves Kimchi, this sweet, like sweet, amazing drag queen. And so we're doing this brand, and it's very specific. Like our colors are pink and yellow and green and mint, and it's very colorful. It's loud. Some of our item names can be a little obnoxious. Some people kind of like, I don't know. Like, so we have the eyeshadow palette that we had launched with was, the name of the palette is Rainbow Shards. And at first everybody's like, are you sure? Like, you want to call an eyeshadow palette Shards? I'm like, yeah. Let's do it. Like, if we're gonna use Shards on any of the packaging or product, like, this is it. Like, so it's very specific. It's like, and we have currently we have close to 300,000 followers on our own brand Instagram page, and we're already doing multi-million dollars. We just rolled out to 200 CVS stores. We have amazing sales meeting lined up with I can't say the name right now, but a lot of the other national chain retail accounts as well. It's doing really well. And so the second brand that we launched was with Jason Wu. He's a fashion designer. And so when you look at the two brands, so Jason Wu, we rolled it out with Target. So we're currently in close to 700 Target stores right now. And when you look at these two brands, it's so distinctively different, the look and feel, the color scheme, that each brand does not cross over. The consumer who buys Kimchi Chic is not Jason Wu's consumer. The consumer who buys Jason Wu product is not Kimchi Chic's consumer. So what we do is we launch a smaller, more boutique-y brands that's very specifically has brand narrative to the audience that we want to target.
Yeah, makes sense. That's really smart. So I'd love to tackle a little more on influencer marketing, because it sounds like the strategy is you're finding influencers, partnering with them, and creating, basically you're operationalizing and commercializing their brand, their personal brand. So for any new brand, you know, how important is influencer marketing in 2022?
So I have a lot of mixed thoughts about this too, mixed thoughts, mixed emotions. So here's the thing. The reality is, it is not as effective as it used to be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. Definitely not. Does it still carry some weight? Yes, it does. You can start a new company, launch something, and then open a Instagram account and you start with zero followers, or you can partner with someone who has millions of followers. And because of their platform of having millions of followers already, when you launch the brand and then launch an Instagram account, you will at least minimum start 10, 20, 30,000 followers. So with Kimchi, the day we launched, we gained 60,000 followers. With Jason Wu, the day we went live, I think we gained like 12,000 followers, so on and so forth. Like, it varies, right? But like, that is very powerful for you, for a brand with no follower, like zero following that nobody knows. You know how much money you have to spend these days to get that follower? or to buy customers. So you bypass that, right? But you cannot build an entire brand or a company just relying on a partnership with your influencer. What you have to do is you have to create products that is so good at an amazing price point that makes sense. And the brand, the products and the brand has to grow its own legs. It has to stand on its own. And then the influencer, the celebrity, like that, the glitz and glam of that is just a value add. And also, it's just a kind of like that extra push in the beginning. It'll give you a little bit of that push in the beginning, but it's not going to build an entire company just based on the name.
Yeah, I see. And what are the biggest mistakes you see people making when it comes to, I guess, working with influencers, whether it's partnering with an influencer to create a brand or just using influencers in general to promote your brand?
Oh my gosh, I don't know what the other brands are doing. Like, I'm not an expert enough to answer what other companies are doing wrong. But I think what it is you have to satisfy, like you're like an agent, like your company becomes an agent between the consumer and then the influencer, right? And then of course, you know, as a company, you have what you want to do, because obviously you want to run a profitable company. So it's that having like constant conversation and the dialogue with your partner and really treating your influencer partner as your business partner, not just a brand name or brand sake, like really like going deep dive and treating them as your business partner and getting them involved in the business as much as possible. So it's no answer to your question.
That's all good. That's fine. If you don't think you can really articulate anything from your experiences and you're sharing your experiences, then that's fine. So look, I'm conscious of your time. This has been awesome, Tony. We're going to move to the rapid fire questions and we'll work towards wrapping up. So rapid fire questions. The first one I have, I've got three for you. The first one is, when is work fulfilling?
Oh, when I see products on store shelves, period.
If you could go back to the first day in your business and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
Chill out.
If you could have dinner with any entrepreneur, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Oh, Elon Musk. I have the biggest crush on him. I'm just being honest.
Awesome. Well, look, we will wrap there, but thank you so much, Tony. Like, this was an incredible interview. I really appreciate you're just sharing your experiences openly, honestly. Congratulations on all your success. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this interview. As you might already know, our mission at Founder is to help tens of millions of people every single week with our content, either start or grow their business, which is exactly why we're partnering with world-class founders such as Damon John, Alexa Von Tobel, Greta Van Riel, and so many more to teach crucial skills such as negotiation, finance, e-commerce, and so much more. So if you'd like to get access to these free exclusive trainings, please go to founder.com/free. These are 100%. We go super in depth on teaching a particular topic, and I know that you're going to love them if you enjoy this podcast. So just go to founder.com/free. All right, guys, I'll see you in the next episode.